I'm delighted now to welcome Ellen Zieselman. She's a museum educator with the Museum of New Mexico. She's the author of the book, The Hand-Carved Marionettes of Gustav Bauman Share Their World. She was a 2009 recipient of the Mayor's Award for Excellence in the Arts, and we're talking to her on the occasion of her 25th anniversary of working in education for the museum. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, how did you get involved in museum education?
It's actually kind of a funny story, but I was a sophomore at Brown and had decided to major in art history, and the Rhode Island School of Design's Museum of Art is right down the hill. And I, being all of 19 years old and really full of myself, I walked down the hill to the museum and was going to volunteer, you know, because who wouldn't want me? And I walked in the door and said to the, there's a woman, a volunteer behind the desk, and she said, can I help you? I said, yeah, you know, I'd like to speak to the curator. And she said... She said, which one? And I didn't even know. I was so proud of myself for knowing that word. I didn't know that they'd have more than one. But some people had come in behind me, and so she wanted to take their money so they could see the museum. And there was a brochure on the table for some lectures that sounded interesting. And as I was folding it up to put it in my pocket, I noticed on the back it said Department of Education. And so she said, okay, I'm sorry. So which curator did you want to see? And I said, the curator of education? I have no idea what she even said. I was just so happy they had one. And actually what was happening was there was a new curator of education coming in. She invited me back to meet him a couple of weeks later, and he offered me a slot volunteering in their art education classes after school, art classes for kids, and doing some tours in the gallery, adding some activities into their general family tours on Saturdays, and it just really resonated, and there I am.
Isn't that funny? I mean, there's so many stories of the little weird moments that determine a person's entire life.
Right.
And it was that brochure and the fact that you turned it over.
Exactly. And who knows what could have happened if that didn't happen. The really fortunate part was that a woman that I worked with there, Susan Pellerin, now Susan Vellucci, she and I worked unbelievably well together. She taught me so much. I worked with her for about, I think it was about a year, maybe a year and a half. And then she moved to New Mexico.
Oh, my goodness.
She moved to Santa Fe, which I didn't even know existed. And I came out to visit her because we'd become really good friends and fell in love with Santa Fe and then kept coming back. And by the time I came out of graduate school in 1989, she was working in the museum system and I knew some jobs were coming open, so I moved out here. So
amazing.
It was really, that one little brochure really did kind of set me on a path.
Yeah, or maybe it was just like a perfect fit anyway. I mean,
Right. Being
a museum educator... In some ways, I would think means you have to be kind of a generalist. You have to learn about every different kind of art that comes into whatever the museum is.
Right. And it's really the difference. It's a difference in perspective between being a curator and being an educator. The curator, to me, it always has always seemed that the curator takes an idea and figures out what artwork sort of best explains that idea. And the educator takes a bunch of artworks and says, what ideas are coming out of this? And so for me, it's been very, very much suited to who I am. I'm definitely not a scholar. I don't really like sitting in. I mean, I love libraries. I love books. I love reading. I love learning. But the idea of just doing research for months on one project has never been appealing to me.
Yeah.
I had an internship after college at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it was there were two parts to it. One half of it was working in a department doing research, and I had a plum assignment. I was in the American Paintings Department working on Robert Henri research for a big catalog raisonne that was going to come years later. And the other part of the job was sitting at the information desk and talking to people and giving tours, you know, in the galleries. And I loved the days that I was in the information desk and talking to people and giving tours. And boy, it was like torture being in doing research.
Yeah.
So it was pretty clear to me that education was the right spot.
So when you're doing education, I mean, you have to deal with people at every level of knowledge who come into the institution, whatever that is, whether it be the Metropolitan Museum of Art or a museum here in New Mexico. And what are the challenges of that?
Well, I guess objectively the challenge is being able to recognize where people are and what their level of knowledge is and being able to communicate effectively for where they are and what they want rather than where I am and what I think they want. So, I've often felt that the essence of good education is good communication.
Now, is a lot of museum education focused toward children?
It seems to be that's the easiest track. It's easiest to find children. There are public schools everywhere.
You bring them in.
It's easiest to, like, get money. People love to pay for things for children. And, you know, there's a lot of need. There's not a lot of opportunity to sit and reflect and think about works of visual art in classrooms. There's just not. There
yeah, that's so,
so many
true.
Other obligations and things that teachers have to get at. They don't have the opportunity to, you know, just stop and talk about a work of art even for 5 minutes, because their curriculum is so tied to testing and some, you know, grading or whatever else outside how their schools are being scored. So it's easy to sort of say, hey, come to us and, you know, and we'll pay for the bus and we'll do
right.
whatever.
It's also an interesting moment because children are so stimulated and probably overstimulated by all the stuff on their screens and devices and TVs. And so going into a different kind of space where you're not looking at an illuminated object, although I guess there's lots of visual aids now in museum education, but where you're actually standing very still, or as still as a kid can stand.
I have them sit on the ground.
Yeah, whatever. But I mean, like, getting into a place where you are having experience with an original work of art that has texture and all that kind of stuff.
Right. I mean, I think some of the most gratifying experiences I've had working with children is, you know, getting them in the museum and sitting them down in, you know, a classroom of kids sitting in front of a work of art. And, you know, we'll sit in front of two or three works of art, and then I'll say, you know, it's been about an hour and 10 minutes. Maybe we need to go now. And they're like, wow, my God, wow, time just flew. And you're right, that sense of just being able to be outside of themselves a little bit
yeah.
and looking at things. And I think it's really important. And I value, you know, working with children in the museum setting, because I do hope that this generation, which has had more contact with museums than perhaps previous generations, will see the value of it and realize how unintimidating art museums actually are and come in, you know, as adults, because they're certainly trying to build future audiences, and to have people see the value yeah. of it. But it's hard because we're so easily confronted with other art forms. It's easy for us as a society to be able to say, you know, every one of us has read a book that we hated or that we loved, or, you know, we've seen a movie where we're like, oh, I can't believe that director, or I can't, you know, like, I can't act, and we're really great judges
right.
of every other art form. I hate that music, I love that song, you know, I can't believe that guy played that way, you know, whatever. But you go into an art museum, it's like, I can't have a judgment.
Yeah.
And it's that's what I've really spent most of my career trying to get people past, is the ability to have as casual a conversation about a painting as they would about a book or about a movie or a theater or dance or any other.
I mean, I'm going to guess that one of the things that makes that hard is 20th century modern art, abstract expressionism, and things like that, which are really, in so many ways, I mean, there are movements that don't even make any sense if you haven't read the criticism about them. There's a lot of art that, I mean, I was an art history major, and I would look at something, and I'm like, I do not get this. And then there was, like, all this verbiage about it that was supposed to explain it. And even at that time, I thought, you know, what is this? Like, you
right.
can't have a direct experience with this thing without being mediated by these critics in New York.
Yeah, I mean, and I would say that I have come to believe that if a work of art isn't communicating, it's the work of art's fault. And that if you need the artist to stand next to you and whisper in your ear exactly what this is about, then that work is by definition a failure. Because eventually that artist will not be around. Whether it's tomorrow
right.
or he lives in another place, or, you know, we're all human, we're going to be gone. So it's got to be able, the work itself has to be able to speak beyond its moment in order for it to be a successful work of art to me. So I think there's lots of art in the world, but I also really believe there's good art and bad art, or successful
yeah.
art and unsuccessful art. And it may be somewhat subjective, but it has to communicate at its core something. And what makes art universal is that it has the ability to communicate to humans. It may not communicate the same thing in different times, like a prehistoric Native American pot is going to say something different to me today than it would have said to the person who made it. But it still should have that opportunity, you know, ability to communicate something to both
yeah.
of us.
I mean, there's a thing that happens in music, which is if there's a genre of music that you don't really like, but then you hear something which is like an amazing song in that genre,
right.
It transcends the genre.
Right.
And it's the same with visual art, I suppose.
Should be, yeah. And it's really just practice. I mean, you have to spend time looking, and you have to give yourself a chance, and you have to not feel like, you know, the thing that's so interesting about Americans is we tend to say that that's not art, I could do that. Which is a really interesting statement of self-esteem.
Right.
This can't be valuable because I could do it.
Right.
Instead of saying, you know, instead of having this communication of like, oh, I should resonate with that because it's something I could do.
Yeah.
No, it's like, if I could do it, it can't be worthwhile.
Or, I think I could do it, I'm going to go home and try.
Well, that would be nice too, but that's never what gets said.
I know.
What gets said is, you know, this whole thing of like, you know, why should I be looking at this? It's not worth my time if I could do it. And it's like, but it's a human connection and, you know, I don't know. So
yeah.
it's interesting too. And then there's the school of thought where like nobody should interpret anything. Everything should just be, you know, you should just come in and view it. And that would be great if people, you know, had the knowledge, the basic knowledge. The people who usually say there should be no labels in art museums have PhDs in art history.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
We're talking to art educator Ellen Zieselman. So have you ever been in the situation where it came time to do museum education for a show that you really didn't like?
Oh my God, all the time.
So what do you do?
Well, to be fair, my job is to find value in everything that's on exhibit, whether I like it myself or not. There's always something that the artist is trying to convey, and it's always interesting to see things through somebody else's eyes. And so a lot of the things that I do in terms of preparing our docents or talking to groups in the galleries is trying to get from the people who are looking at the object what meaning it has for them. And sometimes people like it, sometimes people don't. And I have to say, for me as an educator, if I come across a work of art and I'm talking to a group of people about it and I can tell that they don't like it, that's valid. And part of my job is to say, well, okay, let's hash that out. What don't you like about this? And, you know, with a group of kids, if I ask for their reactions to something and some kid says, it's boring, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Because sometimes things are boring.
Yeah.
But they have to justify why. They can't just, you know, dismiss it. They have to say what about it is boring or what they wish it was different or what would make it more exciting or something like that. So it's not really about liking or not liking a work of art or an exhibition. For me, it's always, in fact, that's been more of an exciting challenge. It's like, okay, I don't really think this is worth my time, but let me figure out how it is.
Very interesting. Now, in the 25 years that you've been doing this work, the world has changed a lot. The internet basically came into its full flower, and everybody's got the little devices, and everyone's on their cell phones, and there's a lot of things that have changed. How has museum education changed along with that?
It's an interesting thing to watch. In art museums in particular, there's been, I think, a resistance to all the flash and bells and whistles because the object is still really prime, and wanting people to really interact with an object rather than be looking at a screen. And so I think, you know, as I travel around the world and I see art museums, there's not a lot of, you know, click here for this or, you know, kind of a thing. I think they sort of have held their ground as refuges from that, you know, screen-based world.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of opportunity for personal interaction. I know that in our museum, because of the prevalence of cameras on phones and people interacting and, you know, sharing photos and things like that, we changed our photography policy to allow for photography in all the galleries unless there's some copyright restriction from a loan, because we want people to interact. It's only good for us to have somebody
right.
showing them posing like, you know, a painting in the museum or with their favorite painting and having that go out online. You know, it only helps us. But that was a shift that we had to have a, you know, big policy change about that because
yeah.
it had been so ingrained that, you know, we don't let the images go out. And so I think there's been a loosening up, maybe even a whimsy, adding some whimsy into art museums, which is sorely needed, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, they have, in both positive and negative ways, I think, a kind of almost church-like, or yes. can have a sort of church-like atmosphere.
Exactly.
Whereas you walk in and you have to be quiet and right. you have to be reverent. And right. a lot of my friend used to call books about artists, you know, like monographs about artists. It's like, oh yeah, there's your shelf of Lives of the Saints.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, obviously respect and reverence is worthwhile, but, you know, it's just a painting after a while. it's just a thing. And, you know, we have this signature painting at the museum by Gerald Cassidy. It's called Cui Bono. It's a Taos Pueblo Indian wrapped in a white sheet leaning against an adobe building. And way in the background on the ladder in the Pueblo is another Native American in a sheet, you know, climbing up a ladder. And I had kids in front of that painting one time, and they were like third grade, and I was like, well, what do you think's going on in this picture? And this kid said, oh, I think they're playing hide and seek.
Right.
And I'm like, I'm positive they're not playing hide and seek, but what a great answer. So we spent like 10 minutes talking about if they were playing hide and seek, what, you know, was the guy in the front, did he look like he was worried he was about to get caught? No, he absolutely looks totally chill. So, you know, what do you think happened a minute ago? Oh, he looked around the corner and saw the guy's way in the back on a ladder. He's like, oh, I'm fine. I mean, they got all of the clues from what the artist had put into the painting about the mood and the tone of the painting. But it was, you know, because they thought we had this discussion about hide and seek, it meant something to them. It related to them in a way that having a discussion about, you know, tourism and the effects of tourism on Taos Pueblo is not going to be appropriate for the third grade audience.
Right, exactly. Well, and it just goes to show that whether you are, you know, a PhD art historian or a physicist or a third grader, you start with what you know.
Exactly.
And that's all you can bring to the next thing. And that's the only way you can make discoveries.
Exactly. And it has to be okay to have a conversation and to look at this work of art and talk about it in a way that maybe isn't scholarly or even serious, but that gets at, you know, the heart of it. Because when you're in a museum with your friends, it's not what you're not like, well, this is obviously a representation of early 20th century socialism. You know, I mean, it's like, no, you're like, oh my God, look at that guy. He's looking at me.
Right. Well, and, you know, the multitude of pictures of naked ladies.
Right.
You know, there was a great cartoon. It was one of those old Matt Groening cartoons where there's a bunch of little kids standing in front of one of those Odalisque figures. And one of them, like one of the kids is saying, the subtlety of brush stroke.
And exactly.
And then the last kid is going, ooh, mama.
Exactly. And you know, I think people take themselves a little too seriously in life.
Well, and the artists who made these things are real people with all kinds of emotions and flaws and, I don't even want to say imperfections, but they're human with the whole range of good and evil in them.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
So, in museum education, has there been a lot of different theories and practices? I mean, are there, like, academic journals devoted to how you're supposed to do this kind of thing?
Yeah, there are lots of different things. Let's see, the Howard Gardner's Seven Levels of Intelligence was a big one when that came out. You know, that people learn differently. The Dallas Museum of Art just spent like 10 years doing studies about what people want and how they interact in art museums, and they broke it down into four categories of people. And there's the observer, who's sort of most of the people, and then there's the participatory visitor, who's like the museum member, and the enthusiast, and all these different things. So, essentially, the language changes, but the topic is the same, which is how do we take anybody who walks in the door and figure out how to offer what they want.
Now, how effective are, I mean, it seems like the things that you're talking about that are most effective are actual museum people, whether they be docents or curators or you or whoever, actually interacting face-to-face with people.
Right. Then, and that is the most effective, I would say, probably. But sadly, because of just the staffing and abilities and when people are in the building, most people who go to art museums self-guide. And I would say probably the thing we're the worst at is providing information on the wall that hits the majority of our viewers. And the best work, the best sort of discussion of how people look, the best research on that has been done by a woman named Abigail Hausen, who's worked with Philip Yenewin, who was director of the Museum of Modern Art education department for a long time, and now they together run this thing called Visual Thinking Strategies, which is a big, that's a big buzz term in the art ed world now. And her research basically shows that, you know, a large portion of the population ends up what she calls a stage two viewer, which is has some experience looking but not a lot of art history. Stage three is art history. Stage four is sort of a holistic, you know, amalgam of things. So I would say I'm more of a stage four, but most of our public is stage two. Sadly, most people who end up being art historians end up stuck in stage three. So what seems to happen in museums is that curators are writing at stage three and audiences are reading at stage two.
So right. Now, what characterizes the stage four?
Stage four is just, I haven't read her stuff in a little while, but stage four is an ability to kind of take a wider view at things. So you know what was happening in art history, but it's less sort of, this is an impressionist painting and more of what that really, you know, this was happening because photography had come in and painters were reacting to it.
Right.
And so much more of a holistic kind of, you know, broader view of being able to pull a lot of different information in.
I think it's interesting that it takes a long, kind of a lifetime of experience to be able to react authentically to something you see.
Right.
I mean, kids do it.
Right.
And then adults who have really gone through life do it. And
right.
then there's that whole intermediate stage where you right. go through intimidation and self-doubt and all of that.
Right. Or wanting to sound smart or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, the jargon and stuff like that is a crutch, I think, a lot of times in art history. I mean, there's a lot of terms and a lot of, you know, ideas about things, but the public doesn't really think that way.
Right. And they don't even know what those words mean.
Right. And we had an exhibit at the museum years ago, a photography exhibit, and it said, you know, one of the things on the wall was like, the tenets of modernism will, are obviously visible in this work. And I'm like, I don't even know what the tenets of modernism are.
Right.
I mean, I'm not even sure you could come up with, like, a concrete single list of what the tenets of modernism are. So it certainly didn't add anything to the discussion of that artwork. And for most people, they were just like, you know, it just went past them because
right.
it wasn't any useful information.
It's like that joke, what do you get when you cross a postmodern art critic with a mafioso?
I don't know.
A guy who will make you an offer you can't understand.
There you go.
So you have been working at the Museum of New Mexico for 25 years, and that means you get to retire and
Correct.
Move on to other things. What do you do next?
Well, right now, the biggest plan is I'm going to work with this program that's really awesome in the Santa Fe Public Schools. It's called AVID, and it's a program to support kids who are on track to graduate but probably don't have a lot of resources in their home life. They might be the first kids in their family to graduate from high school. And there's a classroom teacher, and then they break up into groups of four or five kids and with tutors. And it's really about helping them figure out how to learn, you know, like, where do you find the answers to the questions you have? How do you solve your own problems?
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's really awesome.
Beyond Google.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and just, you know, how do you know what you don't know, I guess?
Yeah.
That's really sort of what the
That's a question
are.
For all of us.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Are you going to try to bring art into it at all?
Maybe, but I think it's really just more supporting just their ability to figure stuff out and feel good about that process. I sat in on one session, and we talked about, you know, covalent and ionic bonding in chemistry.
Yeah.
So, not really art, but it's useful for them.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being here, and thank you also for your many years of service to this community, which probably many of our listeners have benefited from without even knowing that you were behind it.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope so. The New Mexico Museum of Art is probably that's the place I've spent the most part of my career. I started off working for all four state museums here in Santa Fe. I was running the docent program and doing outreach for the Museum of International Folk Art and the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture and the Palace of the Governors. And the art museum, and have landed at the art museum sort of full time for the last 23 years, and it's been a really great thing. It's a place I really love.
Well, Ellen Zieselman, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.